The concept of open systems architecture is all the rage in DoD right now. Among the virtues the department sees in it, systems that can be partially but quickly modernized as new chunks of technology become available, more effective and more frequent competition among vendors, the ability to make small modifications to a system without retesting the entire thing. The department wants to incorporate open architecture into many of the new systems it's designing, but because of tight budgets, it's building fewer new systems than it would like to.
But I have a lot of programs that exist today. How do I get those folks to change their lives to be able to make their systems that equal tomorrow's systems because of the financial situation better today?
That's Katrina McFarland, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Acquisition, speaking at an open architecture summit hosted by Defense Daily. She says taking legacy, proprietary, closed systems and adding open interfaces to them is currently DoD's biggest challenge on the open architecture front. And those systems, large and small, are abundant throughout the military services. The F-22 fighter is a prime example, says Lieutenant General Charles Davis, the military deputy to the Air Force Assistant Secretary for Acquisition.
That is probably the worst example of a closed architecture you can imagine. Single contractor, for the most part, for its mission systems, a very closed approach to the way it was designed, a very closed approach to the software. So if you're going to redesign the core, weapons, mission systems, avionics on the F-22, you'd have a challenge. But there are a lot of mandated systems that are now coming onto our platforms, such as the ADS-B, which is a traffic broadcast system, the Traffic Collision Avoidance System, TCAS. There's Mode 5. There's a wide variety of different navigation systems being mandated, not only by the FAA, but the ICAO organizations to be able to fly across the world. These are being developed by a wide variety of contractors for a wide variety of platforms. You open up the interfaces on that, allow the competition there, you can bring these mandated new systems that we've got to put on board the F-22 and other airplanes in there relatively simply.
Davis also offered the example of the Air Force's Central System for Intelligence Gathering, the Distributed Common Ground System. It also uses a closed architecture, and the data rights are privately held by 12 different contractors. Davis says adding open interfaces to systems like that is critical so new capabilities can be added, and it can be done, even if it's not easy.
We're working with a couple of companies, including MIT Lincoln Labs, that developed something known as a sidecar approach to that, which basically becomes a translator with a series of interfaces that allow anybody to bring a program that adheres to the interfaces to then be able to integrate with the very closed proprietary distributed common ground stations. And you'll see sidecar approaches starting to creep up in a lot. Basically, it's taking an open architecture approach into a closed architecture system, defining the interfaces and let everybody bring the interface to that. And that works out pretty well.
To avoid situations like the Air Force's DSIGS dilemma in the future, McFarland says the Pentagon is putting a new emphasis on making sure program officials take the issue of data rights seriously.
In fact, most of the people in the past hadn't really understood their rights, principally as a government, as a customer, to assert for use of property in terms of intellectual property and data rights. That is a very important area for us to fully understand, because we basically are people who are spending the public funds to create capability for our nation. And in that regard, that investment by the public, they expect us to take care and preserve, because it's hard fought and hard won on their side to get us money. So we want to make use of it to the max capability that we can. So we're very careful, and we've always had contracts that said you shall provide us data rights for all those things that we have spent money on. But we didn't assert ourselves, so there was a loss of memory. And so now we're very active ensuring that we are asserting our rights. We don't need all the data, but we need the right amount of data so that we can go to industry and compete for areas that we want to make modular and open to provide for upgrading capabilities.
McFarland says going forward, program managers are going to be grilled extensively on data rights in their planned programs when they appear before defense acquisition boards.
We're asking for those artifacts to be shown to us. What have you done to create your system to be open, and why? Where did you open up the system? Why did you open up the system? How are you asserting your rights? Do you know your rights? How are you actively working with your industrial partner to make sure that you are asking for the right rights, not all the rights, but the right rights? bit of a challenge.
When it comes to building open architectures into new systems under design and development, Davis says the Air Force has had some early successes. The process, he says, begins with planning adaptability and upgradability into the system from the get-go, with a clear intent to avoid getting locked into a single vendor. And somewhat counterintuitively, he says, one way to help do that is to have the competing vendors themselves design the open interfaces the systems will use.
There's a part of the contracting process that deals strictly with bringing the contractors in the room to define the interfaces, to write down the specifics of the interface. They're not at that point competing for components. They're not building components. The incentive for them is to come up with the viable interfaces that we then own as the government. Now, at that point, if we choose to, and we will on some of these, we could take that architecture and recompete it against them or an entirely different set of vendors. That's all counterintuitive to how they would naturally accept that, but they realize that, you know, they can't slant the architecture with four guys in the room so that it all goes to Grumman. You actually see that if you talk to people that have sat with these folks in the room, it's almost that they, at least the engineers you have in the room, turn agnostic to the company badge and try to say, truly, how does this become the most open system that we then can turn around and compete against? So, but you get them to put the incentives in the contract that says you are paid according to how well you develop that interface in accordance with those objectives and visions we gave you. And that's how you now make yourself viable to be able to compete for pieces of it down the road. And then you have to come back and prove you can build the best receiver exciter processor possible and not worry about building the most closed proprietary whole system possible.
Stephen Welby, DOD's Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Systems Engineering, says even if it's harder to apply open architecture principles to legacy systems, in some ways it's even more critical that those older architectures begin to be opened up, particularly in light of the reduced funds DOD will have to maintain them.
And for those programs, the challenge of diminishing manufacturing sources and material shortages, the fact that we can no longer often find replacements for the capabilities that we need to trade out to extend the life of our systems is critical. The industrial base may have gone away over time. Commercial components, the market's moved on and we're no longer likely to find the components we need. We find ourselves increasingly challenged, and that drives the engineering, non-recurring engineering costs associated with these service life extension programs. If we were smarter about thinking about modularity and we could predict where we were relative to those commercial component life cycles, we could think about ensuring that we have defined our open system interfaces in ways that bounded our exposure to many of these components and thought about replacing subsystems as a mechanism for addressing DMSMS. I think increasingly that's a place where we find a compelling business case to think about open systems.
But at least for now, Welby says, the Defense Department is not well prepared to be a good partner in developing open systems. He says DOD still needs to develop a workforce that's as conversant with open architectures as private companies are. And he says the department needs to develop a systems engineering process that supports open architecture.
In our services, we've seen increasing pressures on our engineering capacity and capability. I think that we need to make sure that we maintain a robust capacity in our product design centers so we can take ownership of those designs, maintain them over time, and be good partners with industry in pursuing open approaches. There are many who advocate open systems as a way that the government can step into an integrator role and then take on perhaps the risk of procuring subsystems independently, providing those to key integrators, or perhaps serving as the integrator ourselves to bring those systems together. A lot of challenges and a pretty poor track record where the government has served as a key system integrator on major complex programs. Industry's track record isn't that great in many cases as well, but we need to understand what that government risk is in terms of serving as a key system integrator.
In Washington, Jared Serbu, FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM.